I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to this episode of the Weekly Zeitgeist. These are some of our favorite segments from this week, all edited together into one nonstop infotainment laugh extravaganza. So without further ado, here is the Weekly Zeitgeist. Before we get into the news stories of the day, we usually like to ask our guest for a media myth, something that people, the national shared consciousness of the species or just like of the nation, believes that you think is incorrect.
Here's a battle that's been going on. People thinking that it's not cold when it's cold. And let me explain this. We live in Los Angeles.
Yes.
We got beautiful weather.
Yes.
At nighttime, we get that high desert sometime. It's like 48 degrees. And you're walking with somebody from the East Coast.
Right.
And they cold shaming you.
Yes.
Because you're cold. And it's like, it's cold. Like, I don't care if you grew up in snow. I didn't grow up in snow. Snow would also be cold.
Right.
If
right.
we was in hell, it'll be hot.
Right, like, right, right.
I'm from the South. I've lived in very hot areas. But if we in hell, I'm not going to be like, man, it ain't hot out here. You got to
go from Tuscaloosa.
Yeah.
Yeah right?
It's like, what? It's like, shut up. Like, yeah. And so like, that's one thing that pisses me off when people cold shame. Like, it's 48 degrees. I'm walking out here in a thin hoodie.
Right.
I'm cold. I'm shivering. No, I'm not about to die of frostbite. No, it's not Everest. No, it's not Everest College.
Right.
But I'm cold. Like, let me be cold, man. Like, that don't make me weak.
I think that's just a way for people who are transplants, they get to feel like, you know, a little bit of pride.
But
like,
that's been
superior. Back where I'm from.
Yo, that's been true everywhere I've lived. I've lived everywhere in America. There's always somebody who is proud that they're, like, wearing shorts in December.
That's true.
They're like, yo, the cold doesn't bother me. It's state of mind, bro. And it's
shut
just
up.
Like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
I just retweeted this tweet by Bella K. Martinez, too, that she was like, Southerners. Snow is so pretty, Northerners. This isn't even a real snow. Just you wait. I was born in an igloo, and I drove to school on a snowmobile. We eat ice for every meal. I can't wait to die in a snowbank. Warmth, never heard of it. And it's like, yeah, that's how people from the Northeast, like, yeah, I knew a couple of people from Massachusetts who that was their claim to fame. Was
Really?
Yeah.
That's so funny, because I was in Boston last December. I was doing a video piece somewhere at MIT or whatever, and I was walking through the campus. There were kids straight up in, like, they had just come out of the gym in wet t-shirt, like sweat t-shirt and shorts, and were just like, oh yeah, this is great.
Right.
And I'm out here with the fucking parka on, with the scarves and mittens, right, just shivering. And yeah, and they look at you like you're a freak.
Yeah. We did an article about things white people don't understand, and I did research into stereotypes about white people that white people don't know are stereotypes.
Right.
And not dressing well enough for the weather was one of the stereotypes of white people, that, like, white people will just wear shorts in, like, really cold weather.
That was, like, a funny vine that was going around. It's like, really? White people, when it gets cold, it was like a woman eating ice cream, like, right, it's in, like, in shorts, and she's like, oh, it's great outside, and then, like, they pan over and reveal a black dude, like, in a fucking park, just shivering, like, talking about.
There was a terror attack this morning, but that was not our president's first tweet of the day. Rather, it was his response to this amazing New York Times article that came out over the weekend. Might have come out on Friday, but it was actually printed. It was their front page article yesterday in the Sunday Times, in the actual paper version. Because I was on vacation, I read paper versions of newspapers when I'm on vacation. And in the paper, it was called President versus the Presidency, but that's, I don't think, what it was called in the online version. But it was just sort of a run through of, like, a day in the life of Donald Trump during the first year of his presidency. And he wanted to let people know that he doesn't watch that much TV this morning in his first tweet of the day. but because that's where the president started, that's where we're going to start. We'll get to the terror attack a little later on. But so among the highlights, he drinks 12 Diet Cokes a day and watches anywhere from 4 to 8 hours of TV a day. There's this great moment where they talk about not just the rumor that he watches a lot of TV, but his response to the rumor. So during his trip to Asia, he was handed a fact check sheet that mentioned, you know, this fact that he watches 4 to 8 hours of TV a day. And so during, like, the press scrum where the media, he goes back and sits with the media on Air Force One, or they come up and hang with him, somebody asked him a question about Roy Moore, and his response was, believe it or not, even when I'm in Washington or New York, I do not watch much television. People that don't know me, they like to say I watch television. People with fake sources, you know, fake reporters, fake sources. Mm-hmm. But I don't get to watch much television, primarily because of documents. I'm reading documents a lot. I actually read much more. I read you people much more than I watch the TV. I haven't been able to devote very much time to it.
Hey, I read documents.
I'm too busy reading these documents.
Well, I'm reading paperwork.
Yeah.
Right.
They put words on the pieces.
I don't watch the electronic flip book.
It's like the press is asking him, sir, did you get a D in history? Sir, did you get a D minus in history? I did not get an F in algebra.
Right. Like, yeah.
We're asking you about a separate failure. The question we were asking you was about a separate fault.
My favorite quote from the article is not a quote that he said, but just the way the article is written. They say, to an extent that would stun outsiders, Mr. Trump, the most talked about human on the planet, is still delighted when he sees his name in the headlines. And he is on a perpetual quest to see it there. One former top advisor said Mr. Trump grew uncomfortable after 2 or 3 days of peace and could not handle watching the news without seeing himself on it. So, you know, when it seems like, wow, we're actually having moments where Trump isn't dominating the headlines, and then he suddenly, like, surges back to the headlines by doing something crazy, that is by design. He is like, whoa, Trump has not been making people completely terrified or angry on a, like, daily basis for a while.
Yeah.
So,
and his addiction to Twitter, basically, and, like, social media, that feedback loop of, like, I do the thing and then I get likes or retweets, it's permeated into, like, okay, now I've conquered Twitter. now go another level, I guess, world news,
right?
Which is like the ultimate Twitter. And I can just be like, oh, I'm going to say one thing. Oh, now look at me. I'm back on the pages. What's interesting too about there's another line from that article about how he'll even call people up when he thinks he has a fire tweet. And one of it says, in June, according to a longtime advisor, he excitedly called friends to say he had the perfect tweet to neutralize the Russia investigation. He called it a, quote, witch hunt. They were unimpressed.
So we want to get right into Sex Crim Watch, a.k.a. Menghazi.
Menghazi. It's a portmanteau.
And that's just the rest of the episode.
Yeah, keep talking, boys. Keep talking.
Mario Batali, how surprised are we by this?
Not very.
Super producer Anna Hosnier was saying that she saw his appearance on the untitled Action Bronson project, and that he was just all sort of out of his mind, just, I don't know, all over the place. And so she wasn't surprised by it. But Miles, you were saying you weren't surprised by it for another reason.
Well, no, I mean, I have friends that work in restaurants, and I know how they like to blow steam off, like, especially after work. And I've also read Kitchen Confidential, which was my first glimpse into, like, kitchens. And these dudes fucking are wild. Like, they're doing drugs. They drink all the time. They're, like, not that they're evil people, but these aren't people who are, like, they're not trying to conduct business in an overly professional way.
Right.
Like, they're just dudes who are in the back of a hot room all day and, like, there's no rules.
Right.
So
just consuming and making things and yeah.
Absolutely. And also when you look at it too, like they're like after like looking into this a little bit more, the hospitality industry has like the highest reported incidences of sexual harassment. Like there's no other industry that comes close.
Right. So this is interesting because I think we've talked about, you know, is this sort of movement going to be just a Hollywood thing? And I mean, I guess you could say it still is because Batali is sort of a Hollywood chef, but that's a crazy statistic that there are industries and the restaurant industry being the top one.
Yeah, there's
85% of employees.
There's an restaurant workers advocacy group that has a like based on some of their research, they found that 80% of workers in the restaurant industry report being sexually harassed. 80%.
That is absurd.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like totally normal. It's like it's almost a normalized part of our culture that we have until now just totally accepted.
Yeah, right.
As being okay.
Right.
I mean, if you watch our ancient media, like say in the 90s or even before, like the idea, like the figure of a waitress in pop culture, a waitress in particular, is just always like a butt to be slapped or
like
a face to put buttons on a vest and then you get to look at her tits because there's buttons on her vest. Like even in media, which seems to be like, as the discussion is this only a Hollywood thing? Like, Hollywood portrays that industry as a den of sexual harassment.
Right.
And the reality is painfully, terrifyingly true. And as scary as a Weinstein is, and he's a fucking monster, scary guy, like, there are Weinsteins that, like, every Applebee's, Chili's, TGI Fridays, and like drive in diner anywhere.
Right.
Like, it or at least in 85% of them.
Right.
Yeah, it's a horrifying, it's a, in such an intense industry, there's a study, I don't remember who did it or where it was, but I believe that I remember it, that the two most stressful professions by just measurable stress level are like surgeon and server. Those are the two. The how hard you work in the restaurant industry goes so underappreciated.
Right.
That almost how hard you suck goes underappreciated. Like nobody sees it. Nobody sees how hard you're working. Nobody sees, how dark and kind of gross it can get. It's just, you know, I guess tip 25% next time you go out.
Right.
Because somebody got her butt patted or worse to bring you that ranch dressing.
Well, yeah, then it seems like there's even some of the other articles about sort of the harassment in the industry, too. It's like it's also kind of a regular story for servers to be trapped in the walk-in refrigerator constantly. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see how this – like you said, if in the beginning we thought it was like limited to Hollywood, and I guess Batali is some extension of that, but we'll see. Like, I hope that this creates a actual sea change or cultural shift in that industry.
Not only not just Hollywood, but Hollywood is reflecting what's happening in the rest of the world. So the same way, I mean, as a person in comedy, this is a crazy thing to keep looking at. But the same way there was a machine around Louis C.K. to make it okay for him to jerk off in front of women and then lie about it, that is a reflection of the machine that keeps your garbage shift leader there at your garbage restaurant job,
right?
Even though he's done creepy shit to every girl on staff. The same machine is working. Don't complain. It's easier if you don't complain. I don't know. Wear a different shirt. He'd right. wear green. He hates green. Like that. Hollywood didn't invent that. It didn't come from here. That was the world. And then Hollywood used that model. And
right.
it there's too much light shining here. In the showbiz, and it shined on some darkness, and that darkness is revealing that it wasn't, it's everywhere.
Yeah,
everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
Everywhere is darkness.
And I guess the question is, will people in other industries have a mechanism for reporting these people? Because the reason that this sort of sea change is happening in Hollywood is because they're able to, you know, get media attention because these are famous people behaving
right.
like monsters. If it's your shift manager at Applebee's, then, you know, who is going to give enough of a
your
shit
union.
When you report? Right.
Oh, wait.
No, unions? No.
Yeah.
More gravy.
No, those were bad for democracy. First off, Roy Moore called and, you know, issued, he was like, congratulations on this great, oh, no. He said,
right.
He was like, nah, the Lord will provide. I can't have possibly lost this election.
Yeah, that's a wild one where he was like, God will decide.
Right.
So, I mean, God decided.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
But see, that's how God works in Alabama. It's like, if it's not on your side, then it can't be God.
But isn't right? the whole Christian mantra like, God's plan? So it's like, Roy, this was God's plan.
He actually said that in his thing. He was like, but the one thing we know is whatever happens, it is God's plan. And I was like, yo, it happened.
Yeah, so
like,
that's
God
God's plan.
Has, yeah. But
God would not like that.
He's not a fan of this version of God's plan.
Are they going to do a recount? I mean, like, is that
no, there's not enough.
He would have to pay for it. So if it's under a half a percentage point, they will automatically do a recount.
Okay.
If it's over that, then the person who's requesting the recount has to actually pay for it themselves.
Okay.
And, you know.
And he won by 1.5%.
Yeah, he won by 1.5%.
Oh, okay. But
so
he
no
could,
way.
He. I mean, there's enough money in the GOP, as we know, that
yeah,
like he could
GOP,
get that funded.
Yeah.
Are they ready to be done with
I
him?
I think they're done with him.
Yeah.
Oh my,
I think
well, that
everybody was
fast.
Like, well, that was embarrassing.
Well, and also they're like, thank God, because
right.
like, we don't then have to be like, hey, so what are you going to do about this pedophile in the Senate? Like,
right.
they don't have to do that anymore. It's like, okay, we'll figure it out down
do you,
the road.
So you think when they were like, we'll let the people of Alabama decide, Mitch McConnell secretly was like, and please like decide the right way?
Right.
I don't think so.
I think
Mitch was like, give me this pedophile.
I think he just said he didn't want to be so overtly against him that he dialed it back to being ambiguous. So that
right.
way, when Steve Bannon tries to attack him, he's like, you see, Mitch McConnell, and we'll get into all that. Cause there's so many dimensions of the GOP.
Cowardice.
Yeah, exactly.
My
the
favorite
horse visual was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The best was horse Twitter flaming him for not knowing how to ride that horse.
Oh, really?
Oh,
yeah. They're like,
ride it right?
they're like, he's holding the reins wrong. The horse looks confused.
I was picturing him like riding it backwards, like facing the ass of the horse.
Right,
side
right,
saddle.
Right.
Like, what? My favorite tweet on this was, from Andy Zeisler. She said, guys, of course the sex predator doesn't take no for an answer, which I thought was pretty much right on point.
Yeah, he's not willing to concede. We'll see.
Also not taking no for an answer. Fox News was their immediate reaction was, yeah, but see, Roy Moore was a flawed candidate. This result is very specifically based on his character
Great.
And not a repudiation of Trump or a shift towards Democrats in the state.
But like, who cares?
Which is fine. That's like a very specific response to that.
Well, yeah, but Fox News is meant to be like the channel you go to figure out like, Tell me it's going to be okay.
Right.
Like if you're a GOP, if you know if you're a Republican and you're really like shook up about this, you kind of need Fox to be like, "Don't worry, man.
And that's-
this guy was like what they said. I think uniquely flawed is one thing I heard many times yesterday, mm-hmm. and I was like, "Motherfucker, you mean he's an accused pedophile? Like,
yeah.
Don't like you know obscure that by calling him uniquely
I think
flawed.
It's good for the Democrats though to like basically Fox News is being like, "Shh, take your bottle."
Right.
Go to sleep.
It's
like,
okay,
and
okay,
we,
okay.
and like that didn't happen when Trump. You know, like everyone was enraged when
yeah,
Trump.
Yeah, we were
won.
Just like, we fucked that up.
Yeah,
yeah.
Really bad.
We didn't take a bottle.
Yeah.
So,
but we cried.
But it's like that's great. I hope you guys go with the rhetoric that like, oh no, we're fine. 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 He was a pedophile. We're fine. Because
right.
it's like, well, then that's how you can sneak in and. Take some seats.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah.
They got to figure out how they're going to market themselves.
This
for
is
sure
sort of how the cycle goes, right? The people who won are sort of passive and, you know, believe that they have things in the bag, and that continues until they suffer some catastrophic defeat, at which point they wake up and, you know, yeah, like you said, giving themselves the bottle. And
I also don't like that there's people being like, it should have been by a bigger margin. It's like, shut up. Yeah. We won. Yeah.
Right.
The pedophile lost. Can't you just like be happy? And I was like sitting as the polls closed being like, he's going to win. You know, like it was astounding that Doug
the
Jones
pedophile
won.
Didn't win. Yeah.
So like, let's just take the victory and like stop counting the tiny pieces about
it. Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right.
Let's thank black women and then like, yeah. And
it'll never
say
be
to
a perfect,
women.
It'll never be a perfect victory. You know right. What I mean? I think people only wanted like 100% Doug Jones. Like then well, they were like, there we go.
He would have dropped out of the race if he thought he didn't have a chance.
Right.
So,
and Trump has been like, see, this is why I said it should have been Luther Strange and not Roy Moore. So, you know, we'll get more into his response and what this means for Trumpism going forward. So we will be right back.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Someone from one of our favorite websites, Right Wing Watch, Jared Holt, who works for them, is here with us to talk about a little bit about the alt-right, and what's, you know, we want to get the temperature of what's going on in the land of Pepe the Frog. So Jared, are you there? You are there, right? Hello?
Yeah. Hey, Miles, what's up?
How are you? How are you? And you're also here with Jack, just so you know. So there's two people doing this interview. So yeah, I mean, obviously we wanted to talk to you because Right Wing Watch is a very great website and tool for us because we would like to keep track of all the things going on. But can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Right Wing Watch and sort of, what your role is there in terms of the alt-right?
Yeah. So, my role with Right Wing Watch is to research and sort of monitor, the movements and the narratives coming out of the fringes of right-wing media. And my specialty in particular is, social media and new media, which, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard, and if they haven't, has been grossly taken over by the far right, and what has become known as the alt-right.
Awesome. So I guess you could say you're a bit of an expert. You've been following this group for a minute now.
Yeah, it's been a couple years. They sort of first got on my radar after Gamergate, which was this big online movement that ended up harassing a lot of female journalists who covered video games and different video game designers for introducing more women and progressive characters. And that was sort of the starting gun to all of this online. And so it's been on my radar then. And then a couple years ago is when I really decided to sink my teeth in and start watching it full time.
And when that happened with Gamergate, was I know that at that point it was mostly focused on misogyny and, you know, the fact that women were infiltrating the gaming community. And were there right-wing politics attached to that rage at that point?
A little bit. It was mostly this motive, and we can talk about this later, that fuels this movement, which is the idea that social justice activists, or who they call social justice warriors, are somehow taking over the institutions they love. In this case, as trivial as it sounds, it was video games. But then when Trump came along, they saw that as a chance to get it into politics, too.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked before on the show that Steve Bannon was doing a separate business venture where he was like trying to make money mining for gold in World of Warcraft, and he came across this sort of Gamergate community and was like, wow, there might be a way to politicize all this energy. So it was like a conscious decision on their part.
Yeah, it was this huge movement, and Steve Bannon was one of the first people to really take advantage and start pumping it mainstream. Even after the white supremacist crowd saw it happening and decided they wanted to use it for their movement too.
Right.
You know, just this online culture of like shit posting and just trolling people and stuff. They thought like, hey, this is a useful weapon in defeating social justice warriors. So we can get these people on our side and use them for our advantage.
Right.
Have you seen, like, obviously Doug Jones won yesterday in Alabama. Have you, just from what you've been seeing, like, in the lead up to the election, what was sort of been the alt-right stance in terms of Roy Moore, or and now in the wake of the loss, has there been any kind of shifting of positions or anything like that?
So one of the core, like, pillars of the alt-right is this attempt to discredit mainstream media and what they see as a liberal order, a liberal establishment. So they wanted Roy Moore to win simply to counter that establishment. They were all totally aware of the pedophilia allegations and, you know, were doing their own thing to try to discredit them. But in the end, it didn't really matter to them because they just wanted to send a message. Now, since Roy Moore lost, the 4chans and 8chans of the world just went into complete meltdown. There's kind of this
all hope is lost, and then another vein of sentiment going on that, you know, Roy Moore was always crazy and wasn't really one of us, so it doesn't matter. And probably one of the bigger narratives is that the mainstream media, like, teamed up with the GOP to character assassinate the guy. And so they're sort of mourning the loss in a couple different ways, slowly going through the grieving process today.
So their conspiracy is that the Washington Post and the mainstream, like Mitch McConnell's of the world, got together and found these women and like concocted this whole story of Roy Moore being a pedophile. It's interesting because they will concoct conspiracy theories about pedophilia to like discredit the Democrats. But when there's right. actual pedophilia, they will concoct conspiracy theories to ignore it. Which, I mean, there was this whole thing, Pizzagate, where they believed that there was a pizza restaurant where high-powered Democrats were molesting children.
The underground tunnels. You can't forget that. And I'll say I've been to that restaurant just to have pizza, and there is no basement. So the tunnels thing really got me on Pizzagate. But show you the level of discourse we're dealing with.
So are there any myths about the alt-right, things that you think the collective consciousness has wrong about the alt-right or the story of how they came to be?
I think that there's a few things. I think one is that Richard Spencer still holds any sort of prominence in the alt-right. He was extremely fundamental in lining out the core and setting the tone and the mission for the alt-right going forward, and was one of the main ones who helped bring it online. But when he got punched in the face on Inauguration Day, they all kind of abandoned him and have speculated that he's like a deep state operative who's meant to smear their movement and everything. So, and another one is that I think a lot of things that aren't necessarily alt-right get called alt-right. And that really discredits the term, because what happened after Trump's election is we saw the alt-right shatter into all these different movements. There's the New Right, the Proud Boys, Chad Nationalist, Traditionalists, and went from this larger movement of people all banded together to help elect Trump to all these different fractured movements that just went to the furthest extremes of the ideology that they thought was most important that the alt-right embodied.
So can you talk about Chad Nationalist? Because that was one of the more interesting sort of subspecies that we came across in tracking the news cycle.
Oh, yeah. Chad Nationalism. Where to start on this one? So imagine your typical nationalism, you know, wanting to serve the interest of a nation first, so leading to policies that are anti-immigrant, leading to a foreign policy that's very non-interventional, but then hand it to some like super buff gym rats, and then also crank their heads full of all these misogynistic views, and you've got Chad Nationalist. So these guys like to toss around the term soy boy as an insult, because part of this, what these guys believe is that if you eat too much soy products, it'll boost your estrogen and feminize you. Mm-hmm. And as the insecure gym rats that they are, not to say all gym rats are insecure, but these people are definitely insecure. You know, that's like the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Right. It's a very like homoerotic sort of, we went to a website where they had all these pictures of like the ideal, like Chad is basically a name they came up with for like the ideal sort of white nationalist dude who like is that they're like he's a sexy hero who lifts weights and like is a hero to women. And they had like all these pictures of like Arnold Schwarzenegger and like, you know, these 80s like homoerotic male bodybuilder types that they were like, these are great examples of like who a Chad nationalist should try to be. Just a very strange subculture.
And is there anything aside from like the idea of like hyper masculinity that like ideologically separates them from other groups, or it's their whole main thing is like, look, we're fucking ripped, all the ladies want to fuck, and we hate immigrants. Like, is that sort of the platform? or is there something like even more specific? Like, it's like, well, actually, we're also very fiscally conservative.
Honestly, I think you got it, man.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, that's good. I want to make sure I'm reading the tea leaves correctly.
Proud Boys is an interesting one because they add the idea of, like, you don't masturbate, right?
No wanks.
Equation.
Yeah, so there's different levels of being a proud boy. There's like four tiers. So for people, for your listeners that don't know, Gavin McInnes, who's a popular right-wing media personality, came up with this idea to create a fraternity for guys that support Trump. They're, again, maybe not Chad nationalist. There could be some crossover, but it's still that same hyper-masculinity boys club idea, and that women should be subservient and so on. But so in order, I'll just take you through the four levels of being a proud boy. So the first level is that you have to publicly declare on social media or whatever that you're a proud Western chauvinist and a member of the Proud Boys. The second tier is that no less than five already initiated Proud Boys repeatedly punch you until you can name five breakfast cereals.
So they're punching you, and you're trying, while you're being punched, you're trying to prove that your brain can work well enough that you can name five breakfast cereals while they're beating the shit out of you, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
It's like being beat into a gang, but with a weird cereal twist.
The fucking lamest, weak-ass version. Like, hey, homie, we're going to jump you, and we'll punch you until you can name five cereals.
Yep.
Like, you can prepare for that beatdown. You could be like, I'm just going to, like, go Cinnamon Toast Crunch Chex Kix Rice Krispie Treats Honey Nut Cheerios. Like,
you just landed five punches, bro.
I'm good. I'll eat those.
Well, welcome to the Proud Boys.
Yeah, right. And then thank you. Okay, so that's level two.
I would actually just, for any aspiring Proud Boys, Chex, Rice Chex, Corn Chex, and just, you're out.
Just go out the Chex list.
Yeah, Chex is one syllable, nice and easy.
What else? Oh, so you're a Chex nationalist. Okay, so that's level two. What's level three?
Level three is the no wanks. So,
no wanks.
Yeah, so you can't masturbate.
Yes, I can.
Unless you're with.
You're not a proud boy.
I have a reversion to anybody telling me I can't masturbate.
Well, you will go blind. But okay, so the no wanks.
I apologize. So it's no wanks unless you're within like a certain distance of a woman and you get her consent. The idea being that not masturbating boosts your testosterone levels and unlocks some sort of secret testosterone, super man powers that I am still unclear what exactly they are.
Yeah, because that's not quite scientifically based.
Right. Yeah, I think they say that to keep the optimal level of testosterone, like, it's good to have some sort of cycle going where you're actually masturbating on a somewhat regular basis.
Well, and it's also built off that idea, like, sports coaches, like, hey, don't fuck before the big game.
Right, which is not true.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, boxers don't actually do that unless they do, in which case they learned it from Raging Bull.
Yeah, and obviously, like, look, if you're looking up to somebody who's punching people out for a living and they're telling you they're fucking and masturbating on the regular, yo, maybe, like, listen to them.
Right.
You know? All right, so that's level three. Don't masturbate and you will become superhuman. Okay, level four.
Final level is to punch a member of Antifa. So it's, this group claims not to be affiliated with the alt-right. But the fact that they're showing up at these, like, at protests like Unite the Right, just so they can get the chance to throw the punch in and ascend to the highest level, I definitely think puts some guilt on their hands for, the white supremacist, white nationalist, alt-right movement.
Right, because I remember...
I think it's a mistake to totally, separate them from that.
Right. Because I remember, like, in the aftermath of Charlottesville, like, Gavin McInnes was really clear to try and be like, yo, we had nothing to do with that, because it's
They all were. Like, these new right people, like the Mike Cernovich, Alex Joneses of the world, they were all doing the same thing. I think after the election, the alt-right kind of fractured, and then when Charlottesville happened, people just started running in different directions.
Right.
Because everyone wanted to get away from the alt-right label.
In terms of looking ahead, what do you see their growth looking like, if any, or recruiting tactics that they're using now? Is it a pivot or is it kind of steadily growing? Like, what's sort of the forecast from your end?
So there's different factions that I think are all competing for the same group of, like, disaffected white people or disaffected especially like young white men, like college age or maybe fresh out of college and couldn't get the job that they thought they wanted to, or like think society is, you know, discriminating them or making them out to be a boogeyman. I think someone put a poll out that like somewhere between 40% and 50% of white people in the country feel somehow victimized right now. And I think the future for the alt-right or the new right or like, God forbid, the Chad nationalist is to figure out how to talk to those people and inject the white nationalism into them and sort of play to maybe these subconscious fears that exist in the conservative voter base right now.
Right. And I guess like one of the last things I kind of want to ask about is like I've read a lot about how alt-right has like one of their biggest problems is getting women to participate. And essentially, since a lot of these groups are sort of built on these dated misogynistic ideas and shit, that they're having a real problem getting women involved. But then there are women who want to be involved in the movement, but they're realizing that men don't want to include them. So like, is that like a thing that even men discuss in like alt-right, like sort of these message boards? Because you see articles about the women talking about it, but it's, I'm curious to know like if there's any like, you know, inherently something that is so discriminatory is going to have trouble inviting more people to the table. So like how is that affecting things?
Yeah. So, to be a woman accepted in the alt-right, you really have to decry feminism and, work against a lot of your own best interests as a woman. And that's really like the barrier to acceptance. But for the most part, a lot of people in these circles think that women are meant to be homekeepers and child bearers. And there's like an insane amount of slut shaming that goes on, or attacking, you know, the media personalities trying to join the alt-right, you know, if they find some picture on Facebook of them dating someone who's not white. Like
Tommy Lauren. Really,
yeah, it gets really nasty towards women.
So, I mean, eventually they're not going to have women to procreate with. Right. To keep this thing going, like it's an odd sort of paradox.
Well, it started, it grew out of the soil of a like anti-woman movement, right? The whole Gamergate thing was like, we hate women. It was just explicitly hateful towards women. So it's not surprising that that would be, you know, a problem that they would eventually face.
Yeah. And I think you're touching on something that sort of gets to the core of it, which is, that, you know, through what you guys have been calling Benghazi and various other parts of our culture right now, we're seeing all these, like, decades, if not centuries, of misogyny and horrible treatment of women trying to come to terms with the fact that women have begun to claim agency for themselves and are pursuing things like careers and, you know, oftentimes being very successful and threatening the status quo power structure that's been in place for so long. And I think that's really like a driving force that the alt-right's going to have to reconcile with if it is going to continue to grow. Because if they leave women out, that really leaves the only option is dominance and not any sort of resolution.
Right. I've described and I've heard it described that, you know, a lot of white people, especially young white people, were born on second thinking they hit a double. And I do think that there's some semblance of like acknowledgement that they have an advantage when you see these groups that are so viciously fighting against the rights of people who are, you know, who society is trying to raise up and, you know, give equal opportunities to. There's like, maybe it's not a conscious awareness of that, but maybe there's an unconscious awareness of the fact that, you know, they have had a huge advantage for a long time and they would like to continue to have that huge advantage.
These young white men are experiencing like the most minor taste of what it's like to be looked over because of your sex or your race, and they just don't know how to handle it.
Right.
Which is, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's something that a lot of these people that are a part of this movement have never dealt with or experienced before. So I think that that you're right. That's where a lot of the anger and rage comes from in this movement.
And then just to wrap up, are you seeing any flagging of the momentum that sort of propelled Trump to the White House? And, you know, obviously there was the Doug Jones victory last night in Alabama. And, you know, are you seeing, as somebody who's been following and paying attention to the, you know, alt-right and just the right wing in general, are you seeing this as like part of a big movement, or is that just something that's happening while there's still this wave of, you know, right wing hatred kind of building at the same time?
Yeah, so there's that wave of right wing hatred, and I think that the people that are part of the alt-right, and I mean like the core true white nationalist alt-right, realize that they're not going to get any of their own people elected, or at least we hope not, in 2018. But what they do hope to do is influence the level of public discourse in a way that pulls conservative candidates to the right, or influence the public discourse in a way that would make people more sympathetic to more extremist candidates like Roy Moore that we saw. You know, Roy Moore was like accused of sexually assaulting teen girls, and that is like appalling enough on its face. But before that, he was this like crazy religious right-wing guy who thought that he could run the state out of a Bible instead of the law book, or what he interpreted to be the Bible anyway. So I think going forward, their goal is going to be more of a cultural one and less on one of promoting like Richard Spencer to the Senate or something.
We'll be right back.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
And we're back. So out in the zeitgeist, some big news is that the first reviews of The Last Jedi are rolling in, and the Metacritic meter says it's going to be great. It's an 87, which is Ooh. Like up there with, you know, the Oscar nominees right now, or the movies that are likely to be nominated for Oscars. It is, the first reboot, The Force Awakens, was at like 81, so that got really great reviews, and you know, people have mixed opinions on this one. But Miles, I know you said you're not watching any previews.
I'm not watching. Okay, so I really love Star Wars, and I with The Force Awakens and Rogue One, I sort of just went crazy with the trailers and featurettes or whatever, just trying to get as much information because I'd been so Star Wars deprived over the last however many years.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, yeah, the prequels were fucking garbage, but yeah, now to see like so many people on Twitter who have gone to screenings and like people whose opinions I respect, like who like good films, to see these people get so excited, like people are really excited about this and just like, I can't, this is great. This, I haven't seen a Star Wars movie. They said this could be the second best Star Wars movie after Empire.
Right.
That's a bold claim.
Yeah, there's a film critic, Alonzo Duralde, who is a really good critic I like a lot, who said he thinks it's third best behind Empire and the OG original Star Wars, which is pretty crazy.
Well, I'm here to say I don't care.
Of course you are. Now tell us why.
Listen, you guys, why are we doing this to ourselves? Why are we letting them trick us? Is it any coincidence that this movie came after Force Awakens and is supposed to be just like Empire Strikes Back? We are stuck in a loop of the same garbage movies being played to us over and over and over again. Let's break it.
That suggests that Empire was a garbage movie. Do you think it's a garbage movie?
I think it was great. But well, I don't need to see it again. I don't need
I don't think people are likening it to Empire in that like it's structurally the same. Like you could say that The Force Awakens definitely was very derivative. Like if it was nearly like
it was fucking, scene by scene.
Yeah,
scene
it was. Scene. It was wild. Like, whereas this one, people are saying, I think it's because it's such a departure. Like, from what I've read, I don't think that people are comparing the actual content to Empire, but
right.
the feelings that you get as a Star Wars watcher, that it recaptured that magic.
Right. Force Awakens, I think, got a lot from, like you're saying, people just being excited, like that nostalgia yeah. wave.
And we haven't had a good Star Wars movie in ages.
Right. And so that came out. Now I think we're at a point where the movie actually needs to be good
yeah,
because, right. you know, there's been multiple movies in the last few years. Like we're at a point where people could be like, if they see a shitty one, they'd be like, I'm tired of this shit, man.
I don't
like,
think
I'm
that's
done.
True, though. I don't think that's true.
I
think Disney has gotten us hooked in a way that it's just like, they're just like, man, we could put out a movie where it's just a poop with a lightsaber and y'all would come back.
I would.
You see, yeah. And I think
that's actually what you're hoping this is about. That's why you're not
that's
watching.
That's what I'm not watching. Yeah. I'm hoping, yo, that it's just a sentient doo-doo. Count doo-doo.
You know what my favorite one was so far? Rogue One. Because it was so different than all the other ones. And that's kind of like what I want from
Edgar's
Last
weeping,
Jedi.
By the way.
Yeah. I am weeping because no one wants to stop making these movies. Do you understand the amount of scripts that sit on desk all day long because people are funneling money into these Star Wars movies?
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's a whole separate issue. You know, like,
is it separate?
I think so.
A few quick hits on our way out. Omarosa on her way out, set off some alarms at the White House. God. So what happened here?
It's the best story. Apparently, I think it was at a Christmas party. These are the only facts you need to know. She wasn't doing shit at the White House, and she was getting $180,000 a year just to fucking distract the president. John Kelly, chief of staff, hated it because apparently she knew Trump so well, she could just say some shit to him and have him fucking spiraling.
Right.
And so over time, he had always wanted to get her out. And then I forget
Omarosa was came in third in the first season of
Yeah, she was kicked Apprentice. Off. She lost on The Apprentice twice, I'm pretty sure. Because okay. I think she also was kicked off Celebrity Apprentice.
Sure.
That's how much Donald Trump is fucking with her.
Right.
And now a third time.
Right.
So she was basically a distraction. John Kelly is like, you're fired. She flips out. She was like, nah, fuck this. You don't. She's like thinks something to that effect of like, hell no, you don't have the fucking power to fire me. He's like, yes, I do. And you're fired.
I'm the chief
and
of
I'm
staff.
Not Donald Trump telling you this. You're fired.
Right.
And she was like, wasn't having it. She apparently called Ivanka Trump, was like begging her, like, don't let him fucking fire me, man. Like, I don't know what I'm gonna do for work or whatever the fuck it was. And then finally, she had enough that she stormed into the White House, into the residence part of the White House, not like the West Wing where they work, but the residence, which is a completely like you can't just run up in there.
Right.
Like you're at
it's
a
like
house
walking
party.
Into your boss's house.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it triggered alarms because you cannot just fucking stroll in there. So it was like a whole ordeal. Some accounts are that the Secret Service had to fucking drag her ass out, kicking and screaming because she was like, this is bullshit. But then fucking like the next day, the Secret Service Twitter is like, we did not have anything, you know, we did not have to escort her out or whatever. All we did was, you know, deactivate her badge that gives her access to the campus. But then Sarah Huckabee Sanders earlier in the day is like, no, she's resigning and she's going to leave on January 20th.
I think as a policy on this show, we can just stop saying what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said just because, like, it's never even, like, remotely true. It's just she just, like, gets up there
and has to say whatever Trump
says whatever
needs
the
her
fuck.
To hear so
yeah.
he doesn't shit his diaper.
It's just, like, a complete – it has no bearing on the truth. I'm so tired of her.
Yeah, so she says January 20th, but then the Secret Service is like, nah, we fucking – we killed her ID badge. So, I mean, if you're leaving the 20th, why are you getting your key card taken away so quickly? And again, then she shows up on Good Morning America today and was just like, the narrative, it seems like now is that she's like, you know, as a woman of color, there was a lot of things that were really disturbing to me in the White House. But it's like,
get your ass out.
First of all, it took you this fucking long. Like, what the, were you a fucking alive during the campaign? Like,
right.
did you think this dude, like, come on.
Don't do that. Don't do that, Omarosa. Don't yeah. start playing that woman of color bullshit.
No, I mean, you had your chance.
You had your chance.
But I mean, if it gives us a great tell-all book, because that
well,
is
right.
one thing she said. She said, I have a story to tell that I think the world is going to want to hear.
For,
which is
for a $300,000 advance check.
Lovely.
Yeah.
That is very exciting to me.
But that, there's nothing better than a woman of color scorned who was in the White House watching all this racist shit happen, because I'm sure she has a fucking spicy one to
right.
tell.
Well, this just goes back to Trump being the easiest person to manipulate that has ever been president. So he's going to have people around him who just are good at flattering him.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so,
yeah.
like, when they, you know, a lot of people who, you know, are just there to manipulate him have access to the White House. So that's going to come back and bite him in the ass. And I mean, Roger Stone also has announced that he's now writing a book about the downfall of Trump.
Already?
Yeah, already. Mm. That is interesting. I think Politico reported that this book is in process, and then he came, or The Hill, one of those blogs, and he came out and was like, well, that's just one of the directions it could take. But, like, that seems to be the direction it's going.
Yeah, when your opportunistic ass is already preparing to bank in on the downfall of the president, right. like, what the fuck do you know?
And you were his main advocate?
Yeah.
Like, that's not good.
You're like, no, I've seen it. We've buried bodies before.
Right.
So I'm
going to
shut right ass down.
Damn.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's Weekly Zeitgeist. Please like and review the show if you like the show. Means the world to Miles. He needs your validation, folks. I hope you're having a great weekend, and I will talk to you Monday. Bye.
Hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.